from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Patrick Cotter, Gail Eisenberg, Josh Cantrell, and Michael Lotus. Our program tonight coming to you from our base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. If you want to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, beyondthebeltway.com, whether you're watching us live on the Internet or if you miss the show, it's there all the time. You never have a reason or an excuse to miss this broadcast. We have four lawyers to this evening. We have two Republicans, two Democrats, and we're going to talk about all the legal pickles that the President of the United States seems to be involved in some way. And I want to begin. I'm going to ask you, Patrick Cotter. You're a defense attorney now, but a former assistant United States attorney in Brooklyn, New York. My question to you and to all of the panel, would you, based on what you know now, just reading the newspaper and listening to radio and television, would you advise President Trump to take an interview with Robert Mueller?
Absolutely not. I don't advise any of my clients to take an interview with government prosecutors. It's just too easy to make a mistake. Whether you're innocent or guilty, it's too easy to make a mistake that could give them either an argument that you've made some sort of admission, which helps them in their major investigation, or, gosh forbid, they think that you lied or tried to obstruct justice. It's filled with danger, and there's almost no upside to the individual. It's not like if President Trump went in and had a really great interview with Bob Mueller, that Mueller would tell his people, okay, close up shop, we're all going home now. So there's nothing to be gained, there's a lot to be lost, and I would absolutely advise him not to do it.
Michael Lotus is one of our Republicans this evening. Michael, I think I know your answer, but go ahead.
Just on the lawyer side, without partisanship, I agree with that. It's just would be terrible advice to tell the client to sit down with a prosecutor. Prosecutors are there to make out cases and prosecute crimes, and they're not there to have a chat with you to just see what's going on and what possible upside could there be.
Gail Eisenberg, a rather Democrat this evening, what advice would you give the president?
Well, I want him to go sit down with the prosecutors, but no, as an attorney, you should not allow your client to do that. For one, I think there's a real concern on the ethics side that you would be suborning perjury, and I would be very concerned for your own law license. And I think we've seen with this president that he doesn't even understand what is and isn't illegal, and he might be perfectly honest about what happens. So not even just leaving out things. I think he might admit things that he doesn't even realize are big issues for America.
Josh Cantrell, nice to have you with us, making your first visit, as is Gail. What advice would you give? You're a Republican.
Bruce, thanks for having me. Very excited to be here. I agree with all the other panelists. No way. There's no upside in giving this interview, and especially given the fact that the interview would be conducted by a swamp creature like Mueller, who's out to get Trump.
Do you think he's out to get Trump, Patrick?
Absolutely not. Bob Mueller is how it's pronounced. Bob Mueller is a Republican. He's an ex-Marine. He is a right-leaning guy. And he may make mistakes. Everybody does. You may disagree with his judgment. Many people do. But to suggest that Bob Mueller has a political agenda is just, in my opinion, insane. There's no basis to it.
Even if he doesn't have a political agenda, he has a professional agenda, and he's not going to have a whole team of people working for months or years and end up with no scalps.
What happens? What happens if the president declines? What happens next legally, Pat?
Well, legally, Mueller could issue a grand jury subpoena to the president, as he can to any citizen, to come into the grand jury and give testimony. But like any other citizen, the president may assert the Fifth Amendment. Indeed, the Fifth Amendment is asserted by people who receive grand jury subpoenas every day of the week in this country. So I would imagine that that's what Mueller could do. But if he did that, it would be setting up a court case, because it's very likely that the president's lawyers would take the position that Mueller had overstepped his legal bounds, he was infringing on executive privilege, et cetera, and they would fight the subpoena in court, because they would not want the optics of the president of the United States taking the Fifth Amendment, because unfortunately the public always assumes that if you take the Fifth, it's because you're guilty of something. That's not true, but I think it would be a huge court case that would come from that. And I doubt, frankly, I doubt Mueller wants to do that.
Wouldn't there be other privileges, though, that he could assert, like executive privilege or some form of that? Would it have to be the Fifth?
The problem is that to assert executive privilege, you have to do it on a question-by-question basis, because you'd have to – it depends what the question is. On the other hand, if you take the Fifth, that is a broader privilege, and you could take it right after your name. But to assert the executive privilege, you'd have to make the argument that this question is going to something I do as an executive. Now, if Mueller wants to ask some questions about what happened during the election and in the run-up to the inauguration, he wouldn't be able to successfully assert an executive privilege. So I think he'd be forced to assert the Fifth.
You're describing, we've all described this evening, as to what the president should do legally. But let's talk about the political, because this is obviously a political, we live in a political world, and this is a political show, and he's a very political guy. I can see Donald Trump saying, you know what, because he has so much confidence in himself, hey, listen, I can outsmart Robert Mueller. I can outsmart this guy.
I can see him
turning his back on all of his lawyers, and then we move to the court of public opinion.
Right.
What happens in the court of public opinion, Michael, if he decides that he is not going to follow his lawyer's advice? Are there people out there in the 162 million people who voted for him? Are they out there cheering, say, yeah, go get him, go get him? Or are they fearful, like everybody around this table, for God's sakes, what the heck is he going to say?
Wish there were 162 million fellow deplorables, but I think there's only 63 million of us. but I let me tell you this. I think his lawyers would have to – he would have to fling them off like Hulk. You know, they would do everything possible to talk him out of doing that. And then what would the public response be? We could only know when we saw the transcript of what he said. And if he managed to foul himself up or walk into something, he could create a just catastrophe for himself.
I have to say, I represent people now, and some of them get subpoenas, and some of them I know this is hard to believe. Sometimes they don't do what their lawyer tells them. And most clients' lawyers can control. But I've had clients, and every lawyer I know who does what I do, have had clients that you can't control. They just insist, I'm going to testify. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go see them. I want to talk to the IRS because I can explain what happened. And I would say that I actually think there is a significant chance. I don't think it's probable, but I think there's a significant chance that for both rational political reasons, because he doesn't want to look like he's got anything to hide. But I think he may tell his lawyers, sorry, boys, I'm really smart. I'm really good at this. I'm a salesman. I can do this. I can talk to him and get away with it.
I want to get reaction from everybody listening. 1-800-723-8289. You've heard the lawyers offering their opinions here from Chicago. I'd like everybody's reaction in the court of public opinion. Do you want President Trump to testify against or be interviewed by Robert Mueller? It'll be a testimony. Do you want to have him do that or not? Or would you have him just say, you know what? The hell, I'm not going to do it. Wait to subpoena me, and I'll do my best, and my best will be good.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. We're offering free legal advice, political legal advice this evening. We've got four lawyers. And during the break, Patrick Cotter, you made a good point. In fact, before we went on the air, everyone was basically saying that the the news media, in their desire to sort of educate the public in legal matters, frequently makes mistakes, and there's a lot of false information that gets put out there. And one thing that you referenced, which is I think everybody has heard, and that is if the president decides that he's not going to appear willingly before Robert Mueller, he'll get a subpoena, and he'll have to come in and testify. And Patrick Cotter, to that you say?
Absolutely not. No American citizen ever has to testify, even with a subpoena. You always have the Fifth Amendment available to you. The other thing is that most federal prosecutors, and I think Mueller is the same, they almost never subpoena the target of an investigation to the grand jury because they know they're going to take the Fifth Amendment. Indeed, they should. And it drags you into a court where now the defendant is in court and he's made a motion to quash your subpoena, that is to say to throw your subpoena out for some reason. So instead of investigating your case and doing what you want to be doing, you're now over here in court arguing about whether you have the power to issue this subpoena. It's a big distraction. It's not something most prosecutors expect or want to do. And I think it's very unlikely, in my opinion, that Bob Mueller would ever issue a actual subpoena to the grand jury for the president. I don't think he wants to spend the next 6 months in federal court arguing about that.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think Mueller is going to basically, to the extent he has a case, he's going to build a case. It's like chess. You surround the king and you checkmate him. He's not going to bring Trump in some grand display. I mean, he's being very professional about it, as far as I can tell. He's meticulously working around the periphery.
Yes.
I want to move to a different subject, and that is obviously we have the dueling memos between the House and the Democrat, the House and Intelligence Committee, both the Republican and the Democratic memo. The Republican memo came out last week. The FBI didn't want it to come out. It went to the White House. The White House said, okay, we're going to release it. We don't think there's anything in there that's damaging. The information came out. Most of the public reaction to that, I mean the partisan reaction to that was that it was horrible. But even some of the media were basically saying they didn't see anything in the Republican memo, that in the four-page memo, that would indicate that any sources were being given away. There wasn't any top secret or in national security issues that were violated in the four-page Republican memo. The Democratic memo, it was 10 pages. It was sent over to the White House. The White House has not released it, and they have sent it back to the Democrats in the House because they say that in that those 10 pages – certain things should have been redacted, and certain things should also have been, you know, they deal with sources and perhaps methods that could endanger, our intelligence gathering. In this particular case, you have the battle of memos. Everybody's going back and forth. The Republicans are saying that the Democrats deliberately put something in there that they knew would be a poison pill, so the president would say no. And then they would be able to make the political point, aha, the president is trying to hide something. So let me ask our Republicans, start with you, Josh. Wouldn't it be best right now, instead of fighting over the Democratic thing, just is release it. Release it, because the bigger, broader question to me or issue to me is, it seems to me it's the Inspector General's report that's going to basically take these two partisan reports and make them almost obsolete.
I think from a political standpoint, you're absolutely right. I think the memo should be released eventually. But let's keep in mind, this is a 10-page memo. This is 2.5 times longer than the Republican memo. So the fact that it needs review and that perhaps some of it needs to be redacted is not surprising, quite frankly. But I think from a political standpoint, it would look really bad if Trump blocks the release of any Democratic response.
Michael.
I think this is one of those issues that's like, you know, very, you know, it's like a firestorm at the time, and 2 or 3 months we'll forget it. They're going to release this memo. It's 10 pages. They're going to black out some lines of it. There'll be some dispute about that. 3, 5, 10 days from now, it'll be out, and we'll see what the Democrats have to say.
But again, my bottom line point here is, does it make the Inspector General's point? That's really the one that should come in with a good housekeeping seal of approval, right?
It should. That's the
one that up front Republicans and Democrats should agree, okay, this is the one we're going to believe. Or are they, or is each side going to say they're going to look at the Inspector General's report and try to find politics in that?
Depends what's in it.
I think that's what they will do, because the parties cannot agree on anything. They can't agree on a common set of facts about anything, whether it's the memos or anything else these days.
Could they agree on releasing the entire FISA document, the FISA application?
And
should they do that?
I don't think they should do that. The point of the FISA court is that these are very sensitive investigations. You know, we've decided as a country that we shouldn't hear all of the information because there are these sources and methods. We have Article III judges who are hearing these cases, who we have gone through the appointment process. In this case, these Article III judges, you know, are almost entirely Republican appointees, interestingly enough, and yet we're having
an Article III judge again. Just elaborate for us. These are
these have lifetime. They have lifetime appointment. They're supposed to be above the fray, above politics.
And how were they selected to go end up on the FISA court?
The FISA court is actually appointed by the Supreme Court. So Justice Roberts would have appointed these 11 individuals. They are on a rotating basis. You start by presenting your case to a number of attorneys, is my understanding, and then you're heard by the Article III judge. So this entire process is, you know, it's a lot more difficult than just, oh, I have a little dossier, and I don't know where this came from. I'm just going to present it, and I'm going to get myself a FISA warrant. It's a lot more complicated than that, and it's gone through a lot of iterations and approvals from FBI and DOJ before it even gets there.
But do you find it curious, again, based on the public reporting, Patrick, do you find it unusual that the Department of Justice and the FBI did not communicate in their written application to FISA that they did not offer the political connections to the Steele dossier, the footprints that went from the Steele dossier back to the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign?
Yeah, with respect, Bruce, I don't think any of us knows that that's even true. The fact of the matter is we haven't seen the FISA application, and that's...
But wouldn't it answer that question, though?
Well, it would, but as was just pointed out, there are reasons why FISA applications are not generally made available, because there are, as you alluded to, there are processes and procedures that are revealed in that. And I have to say, I mean, I think it's worth noting, the FBI formally opposed release of both the Republican memo and the Democratic memo. And that's because they believe, and I understand in your introduction that you were saying that, well, there wasn't anything in the Republican memo that was sensitive. I frankly read it. I disagree with you. I don't think there was anything that's going to bring down the Republic. But, I mean, they identified people in the process of approving the memo. That's the kind of thing that usually you got to hire a spy to find out. I mean, that's secret stuff. Mm-hmm. Who approves FISA memos is very sensitive, and the Republican memo revealed that. And I'm not saying that they were spies or they were trying to hurt the country or anything, but I'm just making the point that these are very sensitive issues. I don't think we can make any reasonable judgments about the FISA application until somebody sees it, or otherwise we're just talking.
Does the President of the United States have the authority to say about the FISA application, I want my FBI to go through there and redact the things that touch on national security issues, but I want the rest of that application seen by the public?
We have three branches of government.
Okay,
the judiciary is in charge of releasing court documents. That is a court document.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
that was something else I heard on the
media.
What
the president could do, and what Congress could do, is they could make a motion. They could go to the FISA court. They could make a motion. They'd say, we want this released, and here are the reasons. And if the president feels it's in the national interest to release the FISA document, he could make that argument through his lawyers. And if the court agrees with him, release it. And by the way, courts make these kind of decisions every day in other grand jury settings. So it's not out of the question.
I would ordinarily agree with the thrust of what Gail and Patrick are saying, that of the dozens or hundreds of FISA cases that occur every year, you don't want to let any light into our foreign enemies about how we're investigating their espionage in the United States. But this is a case that if what Mueller is doing turns out to bring something, the president is going to be forced from office. That's really what this is about. If Trump is in collusion with a foreign government, he's the president and he's a traitor or something, not short of treason under the Constitution. But this is, I can't imagine a more grave scenario than this. Therefore, I think what they ought to do is the president or whoever, however the mechanism would be, move the FISA court. We need what was submitted. We need the hearing transcripts. We need your findings. We need everything. And you would meticulously go through and redact what you could. But the public needs to know what actually happened. I was on your show probably a year ago when I was saying this. This should be dumped on the table, because if this man who's sitting in the White House should be removed because he's in collusion with a foreign government, get rid of him. And if he's not, we need to bring this thing to a close.
Or if it's perceived by the public that he is unfairly removed from office, there's going to be pitchforks in the street.
Yes.
It is going to be – it's going to make the late 60s and 70s, early 70s riots look like child's
play.
Maybe.
And another point related to that is this. The very concern that this – system, this FISA system that we have purportedly to defend ourselves from foreign espionage, is under so much suspicion and animus for political reasons that very system is at risk, and we don't want to do that. We have it for a reason.
I would wonder whether or not in the way that the question would be asked and getting the necessary authority is to find out whether or not the FISA judges, as they were reviewing this information, did they know that the Steele dossier had footprints that led back to... I understand, again, according to public sources, they referred to it as political sources, but they didn't say it was the DNC or the Hillary Clinton campaign. That, to me, would be germane. That would be a piece of information they should know and the American public should know. Back shortly. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're going to head to phone calls now. Brian listening to us on the Internet from Roselle, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air, Brian.
Hi. Good evening. Before I make my point, I have a question for your esteemed panel of attorneys. Mm-hmm. How many of them have ever taken their client's phone and sent out a tweet pretending to be their client?
I can honestly say I've never sent a tweet. I don't know how to send a tweet. I don't know how to read a tweet unless somebody sends it to me attached to an email. I've never taken anybody's phone and tried to tweet or email or even make a call with a client's phone.
Right. So, Brian, you don't think the president should testify?
No.
He will not.
Even though the president's got a good brain and he's got all the best people, including the best attorneys who send out tweets for him occasionally, I think the Donald is going to weasel out of it. He will not testify to Mueller. And then he'll go to rallies and whip up his base and explain to his faithful at rallies that there's no way he could get a fair hearing with Mueller, and therefore he had to take the Fifth because the deep state and the Democrats are out to get him. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's going to fly. I think the Republicans have been playing with fire, and they're going to get burned, and they're going to lose Congress this coming fall.
All right, Michael's got a response to that.
I don't know what's going to happen in the fall. Paul, we're 9 months from the election. It's an eternity in politics. It's impossible to say, especially with Trump, because anything can happen. We could have a war break out somewhere. The tax bill that passed and people have more money in their pocket and that could make them happy. You don't know what's going to happen in the fall.
Let's move on to Lewis in Chicago, listening to us on WCGO, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Thanks. I just have this to say about Mueller. You know, here's a guy with a track record of going after the wrong guy. If you remember, he was director of the FBI back in the early 2000s when the anthrax investigation, they went after the wrong guy. Then you had Uranium One. He dropped the ball on that. They did nothing about that scandal. And so how'd this guy ever become special prosecutor? He should be head of the Keystone Cops.
Bob Mueller is one of the most successful prosecutors in the history of this nation. You've mentioned two cases. Bob Mueller has been in charge of literally thousands of successful prosecutions. The idea that Bob Mueller is somehow unqualified is idiotic. I'm sorry, but it just is. You're cherry picking. You're pointing out two abnormal cases that he was not personally involved in, by the way. And let me point something else out to you. Bob Mueller, the head of the FBI, does not prosecute cases. The head of the FBI does not pick cases to investigate. The DOJ picks cases to investigate. The FBI carries out the investigation. And prosecutors at the Department of Justice make decisions about who to prosecute, when to prosecute, and how to prosecute.
Lewis, thank you very much for your call. But Patrick, I want to follow up with you. My recollection, because you've been on this program a number of times over the last couple of years, you've been our federal judicial expert when it comes to federal prosecutions. My recollection is that when James Comey was under fire for engaging releasing information in the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, my recollection was that you were very critical of James Comey for doing what he did.
Yeah, I think that what Comey did was not appropriate in the sense that it has been DOJ policy, as long as I'm aware of, going back at least 25, 30 years, you don't ever identify somebody who is the target of an investigation officially, and you certainly don't identify things you think they did wrong that you found out about but which didn't amount to enough to prosecute them. That's an abuse of the grand jury. There's Rule 6E, which covers grand jury information. It's supposed to be secret.
We're very critical of him.
It's the law. Rule 6E says you can't reveal that stuff, and he was revealing Rule 6E. So that's Mr. Comey. That is not Mr. Mueller. Mr. Mueller never did that.
I want to take Mr. Mueller. I want to stick with Mr. Comey for a while, because the stuff that really ticked off Democrats was what you just referenced, mm-hmm. how he engaged himself or thrust himself into the presidential campaign and did everything possible to besmirch the reputation of Hillary Clinton. She was helping herself, but if there was a thumb on the scale, most people would say the Democrats would cry foul and say that Comey had this thumb on the scale in support of Donald Trump, not Hillary Clinton, with those decisions. Now, as we look back on what we're dealing with now with the FISA court and who knew what when and the investigation of Donald Trump himself, started when James Comey was still there while he was president-elect and 20 days into the Trump presidency. I'm wondering whether Comey, because I think he even said in testimony that he felt sort of uncomfortable that he was so much a point man in the campaign, that he felt badly. He was felt even sick to his stomach, I think he said, because he became involved in that campaign. He was perceived as the guy that maybe threw the election to Donald Trump. So I'm wondering if this guy, his stomach is turning and he's feeling really the angst here over the – I'm talking about from November, from Election Day until the day he's still the head of the FBI. Mm-hmm. And all these other investigations are starting. The Michael Flynn thing is starting. All that is starting during that. I'm wondering whether James Comey wakes up and says to himself, my God – my actions have led to destroying Hillary Clinton and putting Donald Trump into the White House. And now I've got some things I'm going to get even now, because there are some ways that I can really screw up Donald Trump now, just like I screwed up Hillary Clinton. And in the mind of a guy who's the head of the FBI, I mean, he in essence used the FBI for the reasons that he thought were worthy as it related to Hillary Clinton. And now I'm wondering whether this guy for 60, 90 days, whenever it was the overlap, I'm wondering if he's saying to himself, you know what, I got to be even. I got to even the score here. And you know what, I'm going to get even. I'm going to go after Donald Trump. Does any of that make any logical sense.
Yes, it makes complete sense. And if you look at Comey and the political actor he is, it makes a lot of sense. Look, he exonerated Hillary Clinton 2 months before he interviewed her. We've learned a lot of things about that investigation that we didn't know. She was not sworn under oath. There was no court reporter there. There was no transcript taken. A lot of her cronies were given, or assistants were given, immunity. Unprecedented. He was never going to indict Hillary Clinton, even though he laid out in his press conference the case for gross negligence.
A stunning press conference that you denounced.
Well, and yeah, but let me point something out, Bruce, and I think it goes to the premise of your question. I certainly didn't say at the time that the reason Comey did what he did was because he was trying to throw the election to Donald Trump. But I think the guy was just trying – he didn't want the heat. He didn't want to be – he didn't want anybody accusing him of having hidden this. So he thought, I'll put it out there and then nobody can accuse me of hiding it. But let's stop. Let's stay with your premise. I just point this out. I hate to be cross-examining a little bit, but here's your story. First, Comey throws he so hates Clinton that he intentionally throws the election to Trump, and then a couple months later, he is so regretful about that or embarrassed or something, he now decides to stage a palace coup and unseat the new president. I mean, I would pay money to see that at the movies. You know, I think that's a fun, that would be a fun show.
And to add to that, I mean,
I don't think it's real. I mean, I think that's crazy.
I want to hear Michael's response.
It's true that we have a very strange actions throughout of James Comey, and we have an unambiguous case of gross negligence under the statute by Hillary Clinton that should have been dealt with. I know people who know people who have been criminally sanctioned for seemingly trivial violations of the handling of secret documents, and she had the top server, and we had the former head of the CIA, whose name is eluding me, say that every competent intelligence service in the world had all of the content of her server. So why wasn't she prosecuted? And then we had the strange episode of the press conference you criticized. No one can read the mind of James Comey. He's apparently going to write a memoir, so at least we'll get his version of what was in his head. But I don't know whether that'll be plausible either.
Gail, do you...
Does my scenario
make any sense to you?
No, it doesn't. Comey spoke at Georgetown Law, and he was talking about how he kept on his desk a copy of the request for surveillance of MLK on his desk at all times because he wanted to remind himself just about, you know, how little evidence there was and how the FBI can be used for political reasons and how to never have the same missteps. You know, and I think he took that, you know, that historical reference to heart. And I think, you know, putting together a FISA application or some sort of kind of investigation is a lot deeper than the one-page MLK authorization that he was trying to remember. He would recognize that there was a lot of smoke here, and I'm sure we're going to see the fire.
But then, back to your point, then he becomes a guy that is vilified by the Democrats and then vilified by the Republicans. And now the Republicans continue to vilify him, and the Democrats now think he's great. They can't wait to buy his book.
I don't think he's great. I've never said he's great, and I haven't heard a lot of Democrats say he's great. What we thought was terrible was somebody trying to get him to drop an active case. That is not to say that the guy that they asked is now somehow beatified.
Wait a minute. Okay. If you're questioning his judgment in one area, and I do,
absolutely,
then is that not a flaw of judgment that could repeat itself 2 months later when I'm going to even the playing field?
One's an individual act, and one was definitely a team act with the FBI acting together.
Comey has a history of making these bad judgments. The Wall Street Journal has reported on this extensively. It goes well beyond Arthur Anderson and anthrax and all of the other things. Comey,
we've got to pause. Back shortly from Chicago. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights. at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Just about back in Chicago. Pat, during the break, you were making the comment about we were talking about the morale of the FBI. And Michael, you said that you thought that the FBI, could end up being maybe split up.
Well, I mean, but what I was suggesting, just as I suggested, that the way the public suspicion of, say, the FISA process, it could damage that process. By the same token, you got an FBI that goes back to 1908, that took on a counterintelligence function in addition to its crime investigation functions in the early years of the Cold War. There's always been a question of whether it makes sense to have those two together, even if there's some efficiencies. You may have enough blowback that major changes could occur to this and other institutions because of this current scandal.
Would that be a good idea, Gail?
Not necessarily against it. I haven't really thought about that kind of solution. It's just interesting watching Republicans now talking about how they're so worried about these kinds of overreach and investigations.
About removing an elected president. I mean, it's a pretty big issue.
Absolutely. But every day we're seeing people who are being investigated for, black militantism because they're a member of the Black Lives Matter protests and being placed into federal custody for just being involved in those kinds of protests.
But that's plain vanilla stuff.
There's a lot of overreach in law enforcement. But for the most part, our law enforcement individuals are fabulous, and they're giving their lives and they're putting their lives on the line for all of us. And I think by the vast majority of them are doing a wonderful job.
But to get back to a point I was making earlier, this deals with trying to remove the president of the United States. That's what this is about. And if the American people, even 35-40% of them, see that process as corrupted, it's not going to be good for this country. If we think that we are divided now, and we are, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse with the internet and social media and all that stuff. We could do a whole show on that. But you know what? It's a lot of people on my side of the aisle do not trust this investigation.
Well, just here's a thought.
And I think a growing number of people don't trust the FBI. And Democrats at this moment in political history, they're saying if you are someone who distrusts the FBI, there's something wrong with you. Whereas 15 years ago, it was the Republicans saying the same thing because they were looking into issues of civil disobedience.
We don't even have to go back 15 years. We can easily imagine an alternative universe where Comey got up and read his speech and he said, "We find gross negligence. We're going to recommend the Department of Justice prosecute Hillary Clinton," blows up her campaign. Everyone on the other side would be saying, "What just happened? How dare you?" Institutional threat because of involvement in politics would have occurred.
Or I'll give you another counter if we're doing counter histories. At the same time that Comey had the information about Hillary Clinton, we now know that he already had information about people around Trump who were having, financial and other intercourse with Russians and highly placed Russians and Russians who are counterintelligence people had identified as Russian government agents. If he had come out in October and given a press conference saying, I just want America to know that we're launching an investigation of people around Donald Trump because we believe the Russians are involved somehow in trying to get money to the campaign, you guys would all be screaming.
You're agreeing with me. The point is the public's trust in these institutions isn't what maybe it should be. Maybe it is what it should be. Maybe they don't deserve it, but they're not doing a good job of preserving their credibility with the public.
We are also seeing, as this story unfolds, we're seeing not only the role of the FBI and CIA and what they're presenting to the president, we're also seeing the dirty, there's a very dirty side of politics. We're seeing the Steele dossier. We're seeing this past week now there's a second dossier, a Cody Shearer with close associations with the Clinton family. And the fingerprints of Sid Blumenthal involved in that story. This is another dossier which corroborates much of the scandalous material that was in the Steele dossier. So now we not only have dueling memos with partisan focus on them, we now have dueling dossiers. I mean, the American people, again, since I've been retired, I've been able to sit and watch a lot of daytime television, primarily on the cable networks. And I got to, if you sit there hour after hour, your eyes, and by the way, I love this subject, but your eyes can glaze over because of all the movement of the players. And I would say one of the things that was the most striking to me, because there was also a dump of more text information this past week. And this was a text that was attributed to Lisa Page, mm-hmm. who was the FBI lawyer who had the relationship with Peter Skorich. And she says in a text, that POTUS wants to know what we are doing. She is having a conversation with Peter Skorich. And that was the POTUS at the time, POTUS is the President of the United States, and that's the code. It means Obama. This was written when President Obama was the president. And so you have the first stage here of some suggestion from these two participants who were talking, they think, just between themselves, which is pretty hard to believe that they were in the FBI, thinking that these things would never be made public or at least found out about. They're suggesting that the President of the United States wants to know what they're doing. Does that shock you?
No. Just a little historical context here. You know, you say, well, people don't trust the FBI. They're trying to bring down the president. You know, when Richard Nixon went down, over 40% of the American public thought it was wrong and that they were still with him right up until he got on the helicopter and flew away. So this idea that, you know, well, people won't stand for it, I think that's a little rewriting history. The fact of the matter is when your guy's down, you're going to be against the guys who put him down. And when your guy's up, you're for him. As far as the FBI, two idiot employees, one of whom is a lawyer, so I don't even think she's really an FBI agent, because they're having some stupid conversation where they're talking about secret clubs and I can't remember some of the other nonsense they babble about. These were not highly placed people, for God's sakes. It's a couple morons who are cheating on their spouses.
They were not highly placed.
Do you know what a lawyer for the FBI is?
I'm not saying that she was highly placed. Peter Skorich was highly placed in two cases.
Right, and you just quoted her. You didn't quote him. But the point
is, she was sending the email to Peter Skorich.
Right.
We're going to talk about this. We're going to pause. Again, we have four lawyers, two Republicans, two Democrats. We're talking about all the legal problems that exist in the United States when we come back, primarily swirling around the president. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Another full hour coming up.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Rochambeau back in Chicago. We are blessed with four lawyers on our program this evening, two Republicans and two Democrats, and we're talking about a variety of things involving the president and dossiers and the FBI. But I want to step back just for a second or a segment now to talk about some deeper things that are going on. They're not very sexy. They don't get a lot of coverage. And Patrick and Michael, you were both sharing stories with knowledge that you have about the subject, and that is the basic structure of the Department of Justice is not fully functioning in the way the Department of Justice should function. So summarize, what's the basic problem?
Sure. The bizarre
phenomenon. This is Patrick Cotter, the Democrat.
Right. Sorry. You'll know I'm a Democrat in a second. The basic scenario is this. We are more than a year into the Trump administration, and we today do not have a head of the criminal division of the Department of Justice. We do not have the heads of several of the main departments in the Department of Justice, main branches of the Department of Justice. There are U.S. attorney positions all over the country. Every federal district has a U.S. attorney appointed. There are federal districts all over this country who still, more than a year after the inauguration, do not have a U.S. attorney appointed. These are presidential appointments.
Does that mean the people that are currently occupying those offices make those decisions are holdovers from the Obama administration?
Yes, they are holdovers who were there during the Obama administration, though I would note most of them are not political appointees. They were not political appointees by the Obama administration. They are, for the most part, career prosecutors who held lower-level positions. When the U.S. attorney who was there under Obama left – after the inauguration, they took temporary positions, but some of them have been there for over a year now. Other positions are just empty, mm-hmm. dozens of them.
So it's
crazy.
Whose fault is this? I mean, this. It seems to me that Jeff Sessions has got to be, and I said this during the break and I'll say it on the air, one of the worst presidential appointees in recent memory. Not only did it cost the Republicans politically in Alabama, the reddest of the red states, they lost the Senate seat there. But what is he doing? Mm-hmm. Why isn't he appointing? I mean, Trump can't do all of this. It seems that Jeff Sessions should be appointing more people. And it seems that Jeff Sessions should take greater control over what's happening with these investigations.
I think he's more concerned about saving his own job right now because the president's been threatening him for months now. Michael.
As the Trump supporter at the table, this has been one of the most puzzling things about his administration from the beginning, the strange incapacity to fill plum jobs for which there's certainly no shortage of competent people who'd be happy to serve. And I for the life of me, I am puzzled by this. And it's a huge problem. And even if you have people who were apolitical, they were still the people the Obama administration preferred in those jobs. Why in blazes wouldn't you put your own people in these very important jobs? The head of the criminal division at the Department of Justice, that's like the senior criminal prosecutor in the country. That should be someone that's a terribly important appointment for you.
Yeah, especially when we had politics where the entire campaign he was talking about how tough he is on crime and that we don't have a head of the criminal division. It's sad, actually, if it wasn't so funny. But I agree with you that Sessions was a bad pick for other reasons. As a civil rights attorney, I certainly think he's a horrendous person to be in charge. You know, we've seen him, you know, though he's going at this glacial pace, as you mentioned, in appointments, we're seeing him go pretty quick on rolling back, you know, the work that the previous administration had done with different local police authorities on trying to make sure that we were protecting people's civil liberties. We're seeing him, you know, roll back our voting rights and whether the DOJ even sees homosexual discrimination as against the law. So, you know, he's doing a lot of very quick things to undermine our civil rights and civil liberties.
I would just respond briefly to that and say that on those points, I think he's doing a fantastic job in that he is not at war with the police like the previous attorney generals were under the Obama administration. The law enforcement very much appreciates that they have an attorney general in their corner. But there are a lot of attorney generals. My point is that Trump could have appointed that would have done the same thing. Sessions could still be in the Senate, and we could be rolling along.
You're talking about that decision resting with the attorney general, and you would think that it would. But again, Is this a reflection on the chief of staff? Now, there have been, what, three chiefs of staff already, mm-hmm. and we have a current chief of staff who allegedly is under fire right now. But I mean, part of this, does it go to General Kelly? Should he be cracking the whip with the attorney general a little bit more than he is?
It seems to me that he should. I mean, General Kelly was a general. He was a great general. And it seems to me that he ought to be doing that. But I think he's got a full plate. He came in with a White House that was, by all accounts, in chaos, and he's restored some order, notwithstanding the unfortunate events of the past week. He was rolling along pretty well. But that is his responsibility.
How systemic are those egregious decisions of the last week, in your view, Gail?
I mean,
we're talking about this, Rob.
I think we have to go back before the last week, because it was decisions made to ignore staffing problems for a year, mm-hmm. that go back much further than just this last week. You know, this week we're just seeing some issues of communication and not believing the women. But we've got a White House that just turns the other way in general on women, our women's rights, and on violence against women. And that's just going to be part and parcel for who's hanging out around Donald Trump, because he doesn't see these as problems. I don't think anyone was going to stand up against – going to see the Porter issues as problems.
I agree with that, Michael. I mean, part of this situation is that this White House and this president – they have a tenure on women's issues, women's sensibility, and they are not credible in speaking out against any of the sexual harassment, sexual abuse-related issues, and physical abuse issues that are part of the news cycle right now, because Donald Trump is not believable on it because of his personal conduct in the past.
Political
and
opponents.
Again, he can't become a champion for a subject that no one will give him any credibility for.
His political opponents are going to say that. He's got a very large number of women appointed to his administration.
What about Republicans? What about Republicans in the House and Senate who will be asked questions about they'll be asked questions about the Me Too movement. They'll be asked questions. All the sexual harassment issues that really have become a cultural and political. I mean, it's like a prairie fire at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
How can the Republican Party make a statement to women who they want to vote for them come this November? How can they make a case for them as long as Donald Trump is the president?
I don't see how the Democrats are stronger on this, since at least as many of the people who have been accused of the bad deeds are Democrats.
Yeah, but they're not the president.
Yeah,
that's the problem. I mean, Harvey Weinstein gave to Democrats. He's not the president. The president is the head of the Republican Party. I don't like it. I don't know if you like it, but I don't like
the
it.
Other guys. Yeah, quite
fair enough. Fair enough. But he's the head of your party, and I agree, Bruce. I don't think that they have any credibility on this issue. If I was advising Republicans, and I'm not, and if I did, they wouldn't listen to me. But if I was, I'd say, you know what? Don't talk about it. Talk about other things.
Making a quick decision on Steve Wynn. I mean, that didn't last very long. Steve Wynn, he fell from grace pretty fast, lost a lot, not only the chairmanship or the finance chairmanship of the RNC. I think they acted quickly in that case. They've acted slowly in other matters. Back shortly from Chicago.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Mr. Dumont back in Chicago. Josh, I want to ask you, getting back to what the Republicans can do to demonstrate that they are open to more female votes, because female votes are meaning a lot in recent elections, certainly since President Trump was elected. Is it too simple to say that no matter what the issue, you know, in this area, Donald Trump has always got to come down on the side or err on the side of the man over the woman? Because he's got to continue to solidify that white male base, because upon which that he builds his coalition to win. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a smart political strategy, and I don't think that's what he's done or has to do going forward. This is a president who has appointed a lot of women to major positions in his government. He needs to highlight that more.
Yeah.
He needs to make that point a little bit more. And you know what? In the next 6 to 8 months before these midterm elections, appoint even more women. Show that he's committed.
More than
should
that.
Should Donald Trump and the House Speaker, should they make paid family leave a priority for them in the next 120 days?
If I were advising them, I would say yes, because you've got to bring more women into the party, the suburban women who are on the fence in these elections that decide elections in these swing districts. It's going to be very important.
Gail, if the president and the Republicans did it, would they get any credit?
Oh, I mean, I would be excited for it. I think every opportunity.
But you wouldn't vote for a Republican.
No, of course not. Not in that case. I'm voting for the best person on all sorts of different issues, not just a single family on family leave.
Is that always a woman?
No, not always a woman. No, and I actually I remember having as a young political activist being very upset. When now endorsed Carol Moseley Braun for president, thinking that's not my candidate. Just because you're a woman doesn't necessarily mean you're the best person for women. I want the person who's going to work across the table and get family leave done. I want someone who's going to work across the table and get arbitration clauses banned on civil rights cases. There are a lot of things that we can agree on, and that's the person I'm voting for.
Well, if they went, the Republicans and Trump supported paid family leave, because he did reference it in the State of the Union, although the Democrats didn't applaud for that either. Would that put the president on a continued collision course with his base?
Yeah.
Fight them on DACA. Can he fight them on? And he's got this massive budget. He's just blown.
He won't be on a collision course with his base. He'll be on his collision course with traditional conservative Republicans who don't want to create a new expensive federal entitlement. But Trump is not a traditional conservative Republican. He's a populist. He's reaching into the center. He's doing things in defiance of the Republican orthodoxy that I grew up with. And that seems to be what his base voters want.
So $300 billion in deficit spending and a $1.9 trillion projected deficit is not going to tick off the Trump base.
I don't think so. I think what's going to – not when we have an economy that's been very slow, that we're just coming out of. People want work. You tell me $1 trillion in construction. Those are blue-collar electricians, carpenters, bricklayers who are saying, I'm going to get work out of this.
If he backtracks on visa lottery or chain migration, does he lose the base with
those
issues?
That's where he loses the base. That's where the base goes.
Loses too strong.
But he helps himself maybe with the moderate Republican base.
No.
I don't know if there are such people anymore.
I really believe
the people
that
in Wilmette and Winnetka, I don't think they're concerned about visa lottery or chain migration.
But they'll probably end up being Democrats anyway. They're pro-choice.
You're giving up on the suburbs of communities around the United States?
If I can trade Winnetka for more likelihood of winning Pennsylvania, sayonara, Winnetka.
Well, but there's a lot of
Winnetka.
Winnetka,
these are the Democrats talking. You're welcome. We have a place for you. We do care about women's issues. We do care about a lot of these other issues.
About deficits. You don't care.
We do care about deficits. We do. We do. But we have different priorities. And that's a reasonable discussion we should have. But there's a difference between not wanting to see the deficit cut at the expense of the most vulnerable people in society while other people are left alone, like the defense industry. That's a reasonable discussion that reasonable people can have. I think everybody understands it's better to live within your means if you can. Though, of course, in the history of our nation, we've never actually done that very often.
Never happens.
But the fact of the matter is I think nobody's happy about trillion-dollar debts. Nobody likes the fact that the debt has doubled in 10 years. Nobody is happy about that. But there's a discussion to be had about getting it under control, but it's about priorities. And our Republican friends across the table have different priorities than we do, but I think that there's room – to agree we could have that conversation.
The thing that's interesting is Trump is mixing up what the priorities used to be. A family leave bill is something that is probably popular, that any of the other 17 Republican candidates would probably have done either very minimally or not at all. Right?
Right.
A massive infrastructure spending project is a kind of Keynesian, big spending type of thing. That's the kind of thing Democrats used to want to do.
And we still do.
It still do, right? And, I mean, Eisenhower sort of did it when we were in a recession. But it's sure. Trump, if what Trump is doing catches on, and especially if he gets reelected with this type of approach, he's refashioning the Republican Party, which is yet another big story that's frequently lost in all the details of these scandals that are going on.
I agree with you, but the problem is that what I fail to see is a unifying principle or political philosophy. I think he's just jumping around.
No, I don't agree at all. I see a unifying principle.
The populism, I guess. I think the unifying principle is what'll make me popular.
What it is it's saying we're going to look at – we had, say, free trade. We had very open borders. And you look at who benefits from that. Tended to be the wealthier people who get all kinds of benefits. I'm going to look at that group of voters who were ill-served by flat family incomes for 40 years and a very slowly growing economy, and I'm going to throw everything I have at that segment, and that's what the unifying principle is.
But by cherry-picking, he's going to be able to say, okay, I support a $300 billion increased spending because, again, I don't think there's too many people that – Donald Trump entered the White House with less ideological baggage than anybody in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And
that's
so
right.
He can be a big spending liberal Republican in one case, and he can be – he also can be benevolent on family leave. He could also show a degree of benevolence on a pathway to citizenship, which is a term Republicans weren't even using until Donald Trump started to use it, which could play well in some of the suburban areas, some of the moderate Republican areas around the United States. But then, bango, we're going to build the damn wall.
He wants a
and
deal.
He wants it both ways.
He doesn't have it both ways. He wants the carrot and the stick.
Yes.
I do something for – he does not want news photos of children being hauled off by the federal government.
Absolutely.
Who don't even know Spanish. He's not going to let that happen. But he also has to keep his promise to be tougher on illegal immigration. If he can do both and he can get enough Democrats to cross the aisle, he'll do both and declare victory. And actually, everyone gets to declare victory if that works.
Well, we'll see, I seriously question a lot of Republicans are going to be able to stay on the aisle, if you will, if he starts really getting serious about DACA, because I think there's going to be some Republicans, not because of national issues, but because of local issues, getting reelected. Right. They're going to say, I can't be for that. I can't go back.
I don't think so.
I can't go back to Georgia. I can't go back to Wyoming. I can't go back to Utah. I can't go back to Idaho and say I voted for DACA.
If there's enough on the other side, they can do it.
Yeah.
Voted for – no. When
I love
you say,
an optimist.
When you
say DACA, what piece of DACA are you talking about?
I think we're talking about essentially the same thing. I think what we ought to be doing is recognizing the people that came here as children that are American for all intents and purposes who did not intentionally break the law by entering this country should be treated differently than people who did intentionally break the law by entering this country.
That's both rational and fair. Legislation then becomes – when we talk about DACA, because there's two other elements of what he's asking for. If the final legislation was, okay, $25 billion for the wall and pathway to citizenship, just those two points. There's going to be nothing about the visa lottery. That will drive a lot of the Trump base crazy.
Right.
No more chain migration. That'll drive people crazy. He will cut off the most controversial aspects of what he's promising, and he will be able to say two things. As President of the United States, I said I was going to build the wall, and we're building the wall. And by the way, we're giving a pathway to citizenship for 1.7 million residents in the United States. I won. I'm a winner, 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 winner.
That's right.
Right.
And you know what?
Trump wants
to do a
Nobody
deal.
Believe, you don't believe that.
Well, if Mexico doesn't build it, I think his base thinks that he's lost.
Well, I know, but he'll no, that he'll, one no. he can.
Trump okay. wants to do a deal. I'm going to say something that may be controversial.
Good.
But I'm going to say it.
Go do it.
Immigration is not going to fail because of Trump. An immigration deal, he is there to do a deal. An immigration deal is going to fail because of the extreme left, which is driving the Democratic Party.
That wants an issue.
As an issue. And it's a cynical way to
You know what? I'm going to tell you.
But it is what they want.
I don't know.
We saw this during the State of the Union address. They don't want to support anything this president's going to do. They sat down for the national anthem. They sat down for the military. They wouldn't stand up for anything. They wouldn't stand up when he was talking about how black unemployment and Latino unemployment is at record lows. They wouldn't stand up for anything. That is what their base is demanding.
I disagree a little because I think the Democrats are they want to win elections and they're capable of learning. And doing that wasn't popular. And I think if the option is we got to give Trump something and looks like we're not going to drive him from office before the midterm election, we're going to make a deal. We want the kids to stay. I remember during the campaign, Trump said, the kids, that's a tough one.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
He always signaled that he was going to do something on that. And also his base knows he's going to say, I got the best deal I could. And I think his base is going to say, all right.
Well, let me just say this. If you think that the only reason the Democrats care about DACA is some cynical, we want an issue, you're just nuts. Democrats care about DACA because it's an important issue to millions of people in this country.
And that's why they'll cut a deal.
And we may cut a deal.
That's why they will.
But I will say this. You can't hold a gun to our head and say that you have to build an idiotic crazy
the
wall.
The wall is non-negotiable.
That wall is going to happen.
Neither is DACA.
Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. During the break, we talked a little bit about the wall. And Patrick Cotter, you made a very impassioned statement about why you and many people who have your political persuasion, why you feel so strongly that the wall is devastating to the image of the country.
Right. In my opinion, the wall is the ugliest possible statement this country could possibly make about who we are. It is telling the world that we are literally walling ourselves off. We are so afraid of a few peasants trying to get away from grinding poverty, war, rape, murder, that we are going to build a wall because we can't handle it. Our fathers and mothers handled it. Our grandfathers and our grandmothers handled it. This country has handled it since the day it was founded and before it was founded. But we, this generation, is putting up the white flag and saying, we're going to put up a wall. We're going to be like the Chinese trying to keep the Mongols out. We're going to build a great wall. And it's going to be just as effective. And it's, you know, one of the things that happened to China when they did that is they became a backward nation because they closed themselves off mentally from the rest of the world. I don't want to see that happen to America. America is great because we have never been that country. We have always been open. We want to grow. We want to get bigger. We want people who are willing to come here and work. We don't just want the rich and the well-read educated. I want that kind of world. I want a law, but an ugly, scarring wall that could be seen from space, walling us off from millions and millions of people is just the wrong symbol. It would be the shame of America for all time.
Now, of course, our country has not always been that open, but I think it's a memory that we have to make sure that we all have is that this country has had major problems with immigration in the past where we've shown our racism in our immigration policies. So you have a wall on our Mexico border. Where's the wall on the Canadian border? Just that symbol in itself, you know, you come across this wall, but it's not on the side where all the white people are coming in.
Because they're not flocking in from Canada. The truth is there's the rule of law, and there are people that have lined up and have done it the right way and have come through through the legal immigration system. None of us on the right, at least people that I know, are against legal immigration. We want immigrants. This country was built on immigrants. My great-grandparents came here as immigrants, but they came here legally. And we have a massive problem where we have 12 million illegal people in this country, and most of them have come through the southern border. So it's not unreasonable to look at, well, the solutions of the past have not worked. We need a physical barrier stop this.
We've had decades of failure by the federal government to satisfy the voting public's repeated demand that they secure the border and control access to the country.
Michael, we heard an impassioned description of what the wall meant to Patrick Cotter. Give us your view why a wall or barrier is needed.
The wall symbolizes, and like Trump said, it's a big, beautiful wall with a big, beautiful gate right in the middle of it. The point is this. You secure your property. You secure what you own. And if you've proven that not securing it doesn't work, then you have to change what you do. We need to make the border secure, and we need to have well-staffed, you know, access to the country so that everything is done lawfully. People and goods come into the country lawfully. That's the problem. It's a lack of law. And as far as any symbols go, people came into this country lawfully through all kinds of means. We haven't needed a barrier. And it's the failure of the federal government to enforce the law and to prevent millions upon millions of people being in this country illegally. Bipartisan, multi-decade failure that's finally gotten the voting public to the point that they say, I want to see some physical manifestation of your will to secure our country and make sure that people only come in here lawfully.
Can I point out that the current administration not only wants to build a wall, but they've been very explicit that they want to cut back on immigration right across the board. They want to get rid of visas. This is not, oh, we just want to do it legal. This is, we don't want them.
They want to change the model.
And they don't want them from certain countries.
No, they want to have a Australian and Canadian. No, it's not what we all know. They want to have a Canadian and Australian style system, which is where you have a point system. It's got nothing to do with your skin color. It's got to do with whether you know English. It's got to do whether you have competence and skills that are useful to our country. It's got to do with whether you're bringing money into the country to start a business. The days of our grandparents, like we talked about on the break, where the Irish guy with the, you know, the shirt on his back could come and swing a hammer and make money here, that is not the economy we have anymore. Now, God willing, if we had a booming economy for a long time and we could use up all of the black and Hispanic labor we have here that's relatively low-skill, relatively uneducated labor, and we don't need to bring in – we're at the point where those guys are all working. All those men and women are working, and we can need to bring in foreigners to do it. That would be fantastic. We're not even close to that.
I disagree with you about what economy we're in. All you got to do is look around. Who's doing all the – still bat-breaking work? Who's taking care of our old people? Who's cleaning up our buildings?
People who are here illegally exclusively?
A lot. No, I didn't say that. What I'm saying is there's a lot of uneducated people who don't have points, who don't speak English, who can't, quote-unquote, bring a lot to America, and they're helping to run this country, millions of them. The idea that they don't, that there's no place for them anymore, that now we're going to have a system where only the educated and the English-speaking can come here, is just wrong.
Labor force participation rate amongst African Americans is extraordinarily low. Now, the Department of Labor unemployment rates have come down, which is terrific. We have lots of people in this country who need to be, and you know, here's the other thing. If you don't flood the country with low-skill labor, that bids wages up, that simple supply and demand. Let's do that for our own citizens.
There's no statistical evidence that that's true.
Sure,
the reason poor Hispanics are picking our food for us, okay, out of the fields, is not because they're underbidding crowds of other native-born Americans who want that work. There's nobody else to do it, they're doing it.
If the people who want the fruit picked can't get people who will sleep in their cars, can't form a union, can't get health insurance and get paid in cash under the table, they'll have to automate and create higher wage jobs. That's what the labor, that's what the pro-working man progressives of 100 years ago said correctly. Okay? This is very simple. The idea that the American worker should have to compete with that, it's unfair, and that's not what we should be doing.
Josh, the government has an obligation to its citizens, to people who are here legally, not to people that are here illegally. Despite that, President Trump, and I, Patrick, your story and how you feel about that, I get the emotion. But we have got to take care of American citizens first. And the fact that President Trump is trying to seek an accommodation to accommodate people here illegally is something that I would hope your side would see and would try to meet him halfway.
Here's what I see. I look at the history of this country, and we have never prospered when we took that attitude, that we have to just take care of the people here. We have prospered when we have been growing and increasing the pie. We haven't taken this idea of, well, let's pull up the planks now. We're all in. Our grandfathers and grandmothers got in. So now we'll pull up the planks. We'll build a wall. We'll keep all those other people out because they're too late. This country prospers when we grow. Immigrants make us grow. They don't take away jobs.
Why even have a country? Let's just get rid of the borders.
I want to ask Gail a question because one of the issues as it relates to DACA is for many months, the figure 750,000 was being used as the number of DACA citizens or residents that we're referring to. The president says we're going to give you a pathway to citizens for 1.8. And people say, well, what's the difference between one and the other? Well, 750,000 are the number who have joined up. They went forward and they signed up. The other portion of that figure, they have not done it. And General Kelly made the comment that one of the reasons why some of them might have been lazy, again, he's a lot of heat for that. But what would be your answer to the question, why haven't all 1.7 signed up if it's such a big deal that you and a lot of Democrats think is a good idea?
Well, as we saw, the DACA program they got rid of it. You know, so now we have all these people who are now admitting that they were here without status, and they're on a government roll. And I think that was really scary to a lot of people who weren't trusting.
The 750,000, they did so because...
They were trusting, which is fabulous.
Trusting who?
They trusted our government.
They trusted Barack Obama.
That DACA was going to be there.
Did something that the court said he shouldn't have done.
No, the DOJ changed its mind on whether or not this was the way to go. And now Trump wants to see it legislative. I would love to see a legislative DREAM Act. I would have wanted it, you know, back when Durbin first proposed it.
I want to get back to when the opportunity started.
Yes.
The opportunity started when the President of the United States, through executive order, said,
yes,
we're going to do this.
Yes.
No congressional input. He thought that he could do it after saying for many years that he didn't think he had the authority. Suddenly he decided he was going to take the authority. He was a lame duck. He was going to do it.
Right.
He does it. Everybody says, yeah, true. 750,000 people go up and sign up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm going to go back to the question. Why didn't more people do that?
Well, it's an executive order, like you said. Now we have Trump can come in and change his mind. Executive orders can change.
But they did not believe that Obama was going to back it up.
Well, they recognized Obama couldn't be there for another term.
Or is that the answer to the people that didn't sign up? They were smarter. They knew that the action of one man could be overturned by a court, could be overturned by another president, and they were going to wait and see. So my question to you is, the people that didn't sign up,
right,
were they wiser than those that did sign up?
I think they were forethinking. Absolutely.
Does everybody agree with that?
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens to the 75,000 who signed up.
Right.
If there isn't a DACA settlement, what will happen to them? The government knows where they live. They know exactly where to find them. So we'll see. We'll find out who was smart.
Right. And again, under the DACA plans that were proposed for many, many years, the bipartisan plan that the Senate voted on years ago, that the House never voted on, all of those plans, the ones that all the liberals and the Republicans and the Gang of Eight, they all thought was a great idea during the Bush administration, every single one of those asked those that were here illegally to come forward and put their name on a list. That was part of the legislation. So I'm not so sure that legislation makes common sense. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. As you know, if you're a regular listener or a watcher of this program, you know that we are generally patriotic around here. But I want to ask everybody's reaction to an idea that the president has come up with, and that is a military parade to show our prowess as a nation and our military strength. And I'm going to start with you, Gail. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
It's a very bad idea. My family's from Berlin, Germany during the Holocaust. This smacks of authoritarianism, and it's scary. So beyond just the fiscal concerns that it doesn't make sense if you're going to be trying to save money in our, you just cut all of everybody's taxes and now you have a huge budget deficit, we're growing. It makes little to no sense on trying to differentiate ourselves from the people we're fighting.
Josh Cantrow.
We have agreement. Gail and I have agreed, and I would adopt every word she said. I mean, I'm Jewish as well. That plays a part in it, Nazi Germany and the symbol there. But, I mean, this is a sign of a weak country does things like this. North Korea puts on parades. Mm. The United States of America, we don't need to put on a parade. The world knows that we have the strongest military.
Patrick Cotter.
Yeah, of all the bad ideas that President Trump has had, this may be the worst. It is a horrible precedent to set. I think it's the sort of things that insecure bullies do, tin pot dictators do it. The greatest democracy on the face of the earth shouldn't lower itself to this. We don't need it. It would be the shame of this country if they were to do it.
I don't utterly
Michael.
Disagree with this. You got the idea in France. The French have a military parade every year. It goes back to the founding of the Republic and the levée en masse when the French people drove out the invaders and so on. We had a parade around 1991 for the Vietnam veterans, and it was a sort of thank you to the Vietnam veterans. We had it right down here on Michigan Avenue. It was a very nice parade. It's a comparatively trivial expense. Our military's been fighting these endless wars for many years. Trump basically said they were mistakes. Doing something to say thank you to the troops is fine. I don't see it as, frankly, just a big deal at all. But politically, it's very clever to the extent that that's what he's trying to do, because the one popular government institution is our military, and counting on everyone else to come out and say, this is a terrible idea. If you want to thank American troops for their service, it's like Nazi Germany. Armies aren't the same just because they're armies. The Army of the United States is the Army of our Republic, of our Constitution. Our troops swear a loyalty to the Constitution. There's no analogy whatsoever to troops marching in the Third Reich. No.
Can I point something out? The French parade is actually – do you know why the president was at the French parade? Because there are contingents from all of the European countries in NATO who march. It is not a celebration of French militarism.
Well, that's not
the
true.
The Americans
it's
march.
Not French militarism.
Let me finish. The Americans march, the Germans march, the Dutch march, the Italians march. It is a celebration of their unity and their interdependence. And indeed, there is a special role for the Americans because of the role we played in liberating France from the Nazis. That is not what the president is talking about. He is not talking about something that's going to unify us with our allies. He's talking about a braggadocio, insecure puffing of his chest. And if he wants to do something for the military, let's take all that money and pour it into the VA.
Absolutely.
Let's do that.
He has.
I want to just say, and I frequently will get emails and say, Bruce, you're too much pro-Trump. You're always supporting Trump. I got to tell you, I would agree with Patrick Cotter. This is the worst idea Donald Trump has ever had. It is idiotic. It doesn't make sense on any level. It's a fiscal folly. It feeds his ego. Whether he thinks it does or not, it does. It looks bad to the world. And Patrick Cotter just said something. If you think you've got so much money to do that and disrupt the streets of Washington and create demonstration, there'll be demonstrations against it. There'll be demonstrations for it. It will bring people against each other, not together. And you will have absolute chaos. And it will be chaos in the streets. It's not necessary. Our military does things because they know that it's right. They don't have to have a pat on the head. Occasionally, when we do have parades, as we did in 1991, a welcome home parade, those are absolutely things that we should do. We have a Veterans Day. we have a Memorial Day, and we treat our veterans as well we should when we see them with almost a couple of generations now of thanks and appreciation for what they did. I don't think veterans are asking for this parade. It's a Donald Trump idea, and Mr. President, it is a horrible, horrible idea. Horrible.
Amen.
Let's go to Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, listening to us on 720 AM WPIC. Go ahead.
Yeah, Bruce. I think if the idea is to honor the military and to create a more positive frame of mind about the military with the general public, a better approach might be over a couple-month period of time from using stadiums, either professional stadiums and or university stadiums, honor the troops that way. You can have the USO come in. You can have military people there actually go through drills and so forth on the ground. You can have flyovers. You can have the vets come in for free and everybody else pay a nominal amount, and possibly the stadiums would be donated, and the money then could go to help the injured military people.
There are more creative ways to pay tribute to the military. You've just come up with one. And again, we can discuss this because I don't think this idea is going to go away quickly. I wish it would. But again, perhaps if we get some solid thoughts from beyond the Beltway, the President of the United States will listen to them. Our thanks to our guests for joining us this evening. Our thanks to Sam Greenberg and Fritz Goldman and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com.